WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Elton Skandai from Manchester University on the topic of peace studies. Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. For the last couple of years, WBOI Presents has brought you content for Manchester University's Values, Ideas, and the Arts series. There's been a range of topics that we've heard more about because of that partnership, everything from the Constitution to Frankenstein to the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. And one area of study that Manchester University is known for that has also been a subject of various Values, Ideas, and the Arts events is peace studies. The school has been home to the world's first peace studies program since 1948, and on my first visit to Manchester as part of my work here at WBOI, the first professor I met is Mirror Associate Professor of Peace Studies at Manchester University, Elton Skandai. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We'll get to what brought you to peace studies in a moment, but I want to start with some experience from your early life. Are there any stories from your childhood and early adolescence that you care to share?
Yes. So on one hand, I had a pretty normal childhood. I grew up with loving parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles because I grew up by the seaside. I would swim every summer. On the other hand, looking at it comparatively and internationally, it was a strange time to grow up because I grew up in a closed society of communist Albania in which we had communist rule and we were not able to travel. The only party that was allowed was the Communist Party, called Party of Labor of Albania. And in many ways, one of my memories from childhood was as a kid in elementary school, every Friday at about noon, we'd all be, you know, the whole school would go in line and walk to a bunker. And then we'd just go inside the bunker for 15 minutes and then we'd get out again. And the idea was, we were preparing for the eventuality of a foreign attack. Our government was very threat-oriented, so we were worried that it could be the Americans that would be attacking us. At that time, we did not have any international lives. We had broken up with the Russians and the Chinese. So in that way, it was strange. And I also remember how our parents could not have open conversations at dinner table because they were worried that if they would say something that would be critical of the government, and I would go out and play, and as we were playing outside, I would talk to another kid. If the information would come out that my parents had said even something small, like, you know, the tomatoes were not great today in the market, this would be seen as a criticism of the government because the tomatoes were grown in government-owned farms, were supplied by government-owned trucks, etc. So they could lose their job. They might go to prison. So in that way, we did not have open conversations. So when communism ended, I was so happy and excited to start traveling. And I always loved languages. So English is my third language. My second language is Italian, and my first is native Albanian.
So going from that moment of the end of communism and into an open society and being able to travel, what led you into the field of peace studies?
So it was, again, an unusual route. So my journey as a peace studies professor now actually took me through living in the Balkans in the 90s after communism ended and during the wartime. During my first year in college at the American University in Bulgaria, my home country of Albania fell apart and there were riots. My hometown was run by gangs. I was studying computer science and political science at the time, and I was really surprised because I didn't know how to explain it. Why was this happening? And then the wars in Kosovo happened. The war in Bosnia just ended. So I had a lot of friends from all these places. So I wanted to figure out ways how to build bridges between communities that had been torn by violence and mistrust. And in that way, I found that taking peace studies classes provided me both the knowledge and the tools about how to work on this. Because peace studies actually focuses on the use of nonviolent ways to reach peace and build better relationships with people. And nonviolence here, we understand in terms of not causing physical harm to other human beings. Nonviolent methods can include protest sit-ins, peaceful means to prevent violent conflict resolution, include dialogue, diplomacy, and even sanctions. Actually, my first time where I did a proper peace studies study was here in Indiana. I first came to the U.S. as an international student to study at the Master Program in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend. I was very lucky there to work with renowned experts in conflict resolution and international organizations. And when I went back to the Balkans after my master's degree, I actually worked to create a peace education program in Albania where high school kids would learn nonviolent ways to communicate in communities that had experienced gun violence. So after doing this for several years, then I went back to do a PhD in political science at Cornell University. So I find peace studies countercultural in many places, including the United States. A lot of historical books actually emphasize the role of violence in creating social change. For example, in the U.S., we spent a lot of time looking at founding fathers and Revolutionary War. What is less noticed is that actually nonviolent methods are twice as successful as violent methods, according to research by Stefan and Chenoweth. And I think the more we notice how we're using these tools, the better we're primed to achieve social change that sustains democracy and peace in the long term.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Elton Skandai. And this episode is Peace Studies, Lesson 1. So we already covered what brought you into peace studies. What do you teach now?
So at Manchester University, I teach courses in peace studies, nonviolent activism, conflict resolution, migrant and refugees, and peace building. In addition, we also teach about the knowledge, you know, how has nonviolence been used historically to achieve social change? How has violence been used? Are there differences? One class that I've designed that is works for peace studies as well as for other disciplines has been a class on migrants and refugees. And I find it particularly fascinating because we're living in a time in which we have the highest amount of refugees internationally since World War II. And there's a lot of debates in many Western societies about people who are fleeing war sites. And there's issues with the economic cost of caring for them. There's issues about the cultural differences with them. I actually try to look at, you know, why are people fleeing? What are the reactions? What do they bring to the new societies? And how are societies responding to them? As a new American who was almost a refugee in my first year in college, I look at a lot of the evidence that is coming from the migration literature. And it says that most of the time, this migration works very well for the migrants. They create a better life in the new place, just like I have. But it also contributes a lot to the local society as well. Many of the migrants bring entrepreneurship skills as well as broader connections to other cultures. And the cultural difference is, once you look at the things that we share, it becomes less important. In terms of conflict resolution, I also like to think of ways of how conflict is natural. People, reasonable people, will disagree with each other. On the other hand, what's not natural is the assumption that we often have to fight and use violence. We don't have to. Almost any conflict can be transformed into a win-win conflict resolution where both sides can get something and then move on. It's only if you start by saying, in order for me to win, you have to lose, then we turn the conflicts into so-called lose-lose-lose. Both sides will try to spite each other and fight. So that's, and I try to do that not only in terms of interpersonal relations, but also in terms of global relations. So in my classes, we use a lot of role plays and simulations. I have students role play themselves in students' roles, as well as in international crises where they have to be United Nations representative, U.S. diplomats, non-governmental organizations, politicians, and then even refugees and internally displaced people. And they have to be part of peace negotiations to try to come up with peace agreements. This is important because one of the findings that is coming up right now is that most civil wars, most wars now end in peace agreement. They don't end with a clear victory. And the best ways for the peace agreements to be sustainable so that there's no war in the future is for them to be inclusive. So by including diverse groups of people, by including more women, by including more marginalized people, by including more even refugees and hearing about their sense about what would make their place safe for them to return, we're better able to come up with an agreement that satisfies everyone and it works.
Care to share a little bit about your research with our listeners and how do you see it creating conversations with your students?
My research focuses on the importance of institutions in post-war contexts and how can we reach situations in which societies that have emerged out of war, out of intense polarization, out of ethnic cleavages, how can we reach a situation in which they don't go back to war, there is some reconciliation, people are able to talk, people are able to do normal things, go to school, get a job, get married, have children, go about their daily life without worrying that violence is going to strike again. So in that way, kind of, I've published books and articles on the importance of creating democratic institutions, political contestation when there is more than one party, rule of law institutions in which no one is above the law, the elite politicians are not doing whatever they want, they can't get away with corruption. And also talking a bit about how people work with each other in terms of polarization. One thing that I do increasingly in my classes here at Manchester University in Indiana has been the use of dialogue circles. And we use dialogue circles in the Balkans to try and bridge differences between groups of different ethnicities, the Albanians and the Serbs and the Croats and the Bosnians. And now I actually use it in our classroom to talk about issues that polarize Americans. So we have dialogue circles on gun violence. We have dialogue circles on gender and gender equality. And what's very impressive is that once you take the attention away from the debate so that you don't have to win your point, but you're building on other people's ideas and you're working with them, what you find is that a lot of the students actually agree on 70-80% of the time. So that, you know, as a tool, dialogue is such a peace studies tool. It does not necessarily transform your viewpoint immediately, but it allows you to see how many shared concerns, hopes you have for the future with other people. So it builds then a common ground, which then allows you to work with the other and build something better in the future. So a lot of the processes, such processes then take time. There's no magic solution that you do it right now and then tomorrow it's going to be great. But I think as the start, we need to be able to talk to each other, share our concerns, hear about each other's fears, and then come up with that common ground so that we cooperate. There's a lot of games of cooperations that we do in the classroom to essentially highlight the importance of reciprocity, golden rule. Most games of cooperation can be won by applying the golden rules. You start by collaborating with the other, so give an open hand. And then if the other person collaborate or the other side collaborate, keep collaborating. If the other side does not collaborate, take note and say, well, since you didn't collaborate this time, I'm not going to collaborate next time, but I'm going to give you the option to collaborate later, and I will still collaborate with you. So you don't hold a grudge. And that has been actually, over time, that powerful insight has allowed for transformed relationships between people who would view themselves as enemies, as well as transformed relationships between countries that viewed each other as enemies. And here, I mean, as a new American who was originally from Albania, I can attest to the power of transformation. But Albania used to think of the United States as an enemy. Right now, Albanians and Poles in Europe are some of the most pro-American people that you can find globally. So it's like very strong alliances. So change can happen like that.
You mentioned some of the difficult conversations and topics you're able to address in the classroom thanks to cooperative dialogue. Before we entered the studio today, we knew we wanted to take a look at some of the major international issues that have been talked about. Well, going back to 2016 and since the beginning of the Trump administration, and you have things like trade wars, our relationship with North Korea. How do you go about addressing those topics in the classroom? And is it possible to do it in a way that transcends politics, or is that just inescapable?
So we do discuss about such topics in the classroom. And there is ways to actually transcend politics in terms of looking at it as, here are the actors, here's what's happening, and how is this achieving constructive conflict resolution outcomes or not. Sometimes there is a level of discomfort if, you know, certain students feel that they have to support a certain view, and we recognize that discomfort and we just allow it. The classroom is in many ways an open space where people will be able to just say, well, I don't agree with this and here's why. But it's one thing though to have an opinion on something, but another thing, what we try to promote is critical thinking and support by evidence. Even as a professor or as a student, if I'm just giving an opinion, but I'm not providing evidence for it, that in the classroom and academic settings, you know, that position is not as tenable as another position in which people are providing an argument that is well supported by evidence. So one thing then, when we talk about a lot of the recent kind of, you know, one common pattern that we see in terms of U.S. trade wars, U.S. and North Korea conflict, and right now with U.S. and Iran, is that the United States, thinking in terms of conflict resolution, start by actually coming up with a high, like a strong position. I want you to do this, otherwise you'll be punished. And that doesn't kind of basic conflict resolution 101 work a lot of the time. And we've seen it with, for example, take a look at U.S. trade war with China and European partners in Canada. When the U.S. bypasses multilateral institutions such as World Trade Organizations, and the White House says, we're going to put tariffs on your goods, which are essentially taxes that we as American consumers are paying for those goods. Immediately, the other side says, okay, we're going to put tariffs on you for American goods. And that's the reciprocity. That's where a lot of negotiations are built on. And again, if you start by cooperating, and that's what the U.S. has been doing successfully since the end of World War II, we did not try to punish Germany and Japan after they lost in World War II. We actually tried to work with them, help rebuild them, and cooperate with them. And that's why they're our allies. If we had tried to punish and put them down, they would not be our allies right now. The same thing with China. I think it's unreasonable to expect that the U.S. trade negotiations will be conducted by just the president. Trade negotiations are very complex matters that require a lot of expertise that varies according to the, you know, so you'd have people who know a lot about soybeans in the Midwest, for example, as well as the production of technology in China, who'd need to come out and look at details and come up with a draft that goes through a lot of discussions before it goes to the top. Right now, I think it's partly because of the way the idea of such negotiations becoming issues where only the leaders are discussing that actually are not as beneficial for achieving better results. Now, if we look at, for example, our interactions with Iran, so there is a kind of broader history of both negative and positive interactions that we've had with Iran. But recently, we've had more negative interactions. A lot of American policymakers would consider Iran an enemy, and Iran would consider the U.S. an enemy too. Here I'd like to pause because there is one big difference, I think, between the Cold War and right now, where even though people might consider the other government an enemy, there's enough communication right now through globalization that people are recognizing that the people are not the enemy, it's the government. Many Iranians don't like the U.S. government, but they actually like the U.S. culture and would like to meet Americans. Similarly, I think many Americans distrust the Iranian government, but they don't view the Iranian people as necessarily bad. To me, that's a positive because it allows us to differentiate. So with Iran, you know, we've had a concern about Iranians developing nuclear weapons, and Iranians have wanted to use nuclear power without ever saying that they will create nuclear weapons. So you had negotiations under Obama administration that involved our European partners with Iran, where we came up with an agreement so that they would not enrich their uranium. They would not have the capability of creating a nuclear weapon. One of the first things that Trump administration does is walk out of this agreement. Now, one measure of whether this was positive or not is to look at our old allies. All our allies said, we will continue to work with Iran to uphold their agreements. This made the Germans and the French and the Canadians very upset because they don't want the alternative to an agreement would be escalation that could lead to war. So for Iranians, this was seen as a slap in the face. And within the Iranian politics, the agreement was a victory by Iranian moderates. who said we should be able to communicate and reach an agreement with others. So when the U.S. walks out on the agreement, this is a victory for the conservative, the more radical religious part of the Iranian elites. So then you have escalation where there's tit for tat, you do this, I'll do this, but it's more on a negative, vicious circle until you come up to recent events when you have President Trump ordering the killing of General Soleimani. He's like the second-ranked politician, powerful individual in Iran, and as well as the leading military official. Now, one thing to note here is that there's been a pattern of using drone warfare by the other presidents. President Obama has used it to kill individuals that were deemed dangerous to U.S. politics. For Iranians and for the rest of the world, though, such political association are seen as not legitimate and illegal in international law. So I think we need to pause here, because if we're seen as not following international law, then for the competitors, they don't have to follow it, and they can use the same tools to exercise reciprocity toward the Americans. So it's not for many critics of such assassinations, do not think that Soleimani was a great guy, etc. He was a mastermind of Middle Eastern politics, using military tools to encourage Iraqis, the Hezbollah, etc., to attack Americans and their allies on the ground. But that doesn't mean, though, that it's appropriate to assassinate them. So what this does then, even for people who would be moderates in Iran, this unifies many of them into think that, see, this is what America does. We cannot trust America. So it's really the new low that makes getting to an agreement a lot harder. And here, it's very important to talk about credibility. Because we're not just doing something with one particular country, with Iran. But if we're not credible in our interactions with Iran or Mexico, then how can we be credible when we do try to negotiate with North Korea? Imagine from a North Korean perspective where they view having a nuclear weapon as a safeguard for their own regime. Why would they agree to kind of get rid of their nuclear weapons with one American president if they see what happens with Iranians? And they say, well, the next American presidents can walk out of that agreement, and now we don't have nukes. So I think right now we are noticing a general decline in credibility of U.S. politics, general decline of credibility of our words, our diplomats. So I think I find that troubling, because I believe in the ideals of America and how we can use these ideals to promote positive change around the world. But for that, people need to trust us.
Eldon Skandai, thank you so much for sharing your story as well as your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org, and while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team, and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship, Steve Mullaney, and Sydney Wagner. Thank you for listening. From WBOI, Fort Wayne.